Succession number 28528, Reel 2.
Denny Swainson, Reel 2.
I got there by borrowing a battered old car from Jim Wilson, who was later General Sir James Wilson and fought beside me in Tunisia most of the time. And oddly, recently I wrote a history with partly of my war experiences and partly of the three sports I played to international level, soccer, cricket and fly fishing. And I mentioned in the book this battered old car, which I said was only worth £5. And unfortunately, Jim incidentally had said that if anything went wrong, I was to claim it as my car because it wasn't insured or licensed or anything like that. And on the way back, I had to go up this rather formidable, winding Ural Hill. And this little car wouldn't quite make it at the time, so I had the bright idea of pushing it into a drive near the top, turning it round, there, pushing it back, facing backwards, and doing the last little bit in reverse, which would be more powerful. Unfortunately, I hadn't realised how steep was the drive, and the car ran away from me and crashed into a fortunately deserted house porch at the bottom. So I had a long walk back to Tidworth and then had to bribe the MT sergeant to come out and pick it up for me. It was so battered I don't think James Wilson ever noted the difference, so I got away with that. But oddly, soon after I'd written this book last year, so we're now talking 2004, I was stopped in the Winchester Cathedral by somebody who said, "You're the man who battered my car." I said, "I haven't run into anything for ages." And he said, "Oh, I've had your book and I recognise you from the picture, and I'm the man who sold the car to James Wilson, and I did sell it to him for exactly £5. So I was glad to see I wasn't romancing on that. So went on like that, but again in the training with Jim Wilson, I was put in charge. He was the man totally in charge. I was his assistant in what the colonel in charge was calling the demonstration platoon, and we were told we had to be so good that we could give demonstrations to all the others. And the man in charge was Colonel Taylor, who had been the only officer to escape from Calais, where they did this Green Jackets did this marvellous delaying action. He only escaped because he'd been wounded and he went off in the hospital ship just before. And the rest, of course, unfortunately, first they were told that they would be taken off by ship on a certain night and therefore they were to destroy all their major armoury. But then that order was countermanded at the last moment and they were told it was a last man, last round, no retreat, no surrender job. And so they fought brilliantly just long enough to really allow probably an extra 150,000 or so were saved by their fight there, which was terrific. But Taylor had a very long and formidable moustache and was a very short-tempered man. Everybody was scared of him, including me, but particularly the rifleman. And there was one occasion where I was leading the demonstration platoon down for a practice with Bren guns. And we came to a T-junction only to find Taylor standing at the area there. And I had to go to the right, so I gave the whole platoon a loud right wheel command, but they were all so transfixed looking at Taylor that they marched straight on while I wheeled right off my own. And having got a suitable blast and so on, when we got to the Bren gun practice in the usual way with the army, I did explanation, demonstration, practice. And I gave the explanation and then turned to my sergeant and said, "Now give the demonstration," where Taylor interrupted and said, "No, officers must be better than their men. you give the demonstration, hoping, I think, to catch me out again. But of course these months of Bren Gunn stripping and reassembling blindfold came to my aid, so when I got down I whipped through it at speed, and then I said, somebody blindfold me and whip through it, because you may have to do it at night, and whipped through nearly at speed again, and then got up, saluted in my bravest act of the war, said, senior officers have to do it better than junior ones, would you like a go, sir? To his credit, he had a try, but the thing just fell to pieces in his hand, and we didn't see him for 2 days after that. But it wasn't long before we were moved up to Scotland, Darwell, near Troon, to join the 6th Armoured Division, and that was when my real training started. Darwell was a terrible place. When we arrived, there was a camp there, but being Scotland, it rained so consistently that even the duck boards put down to walk across the mud were soon afloat. And then, fortunately, some of us got put in billets, and I was in a billet with a baker. It used to be amusing to me. I come up, hopefully smartly dressed in uniform, having had my breakfast, and meet my host coming back white covered with flour and his day's work over while I started mine. We then had there one of the big events we had was a 3-day major exercise, and I recall I was then in charge of the carrier platoon, and we were told to assault a hill, and halfway through one of the umpires came up and said, you're under shell fire. And in the briefing afterwards, I remember there was a bit of criticism of me that I hadn't speeded up when told I was under shell fire. But of course, actually, that's a difficult decision, because if you speed up, you may run into unseen anti-tank guns. But later on, a reminder of it did do me good at the end of the North African War. And so that was... we did have some real training then, and then just waited to be sent abroad, and finally got the message that we were going to be on our way shortly. So on this training, the only thing was that for much of it, the problem in the training then was that the war was all in the desert, and the tactics for the desert didn't necessarily suit European conditions or Scottish hills or whatever. And so our normal formation was a box formation, we were told, with the tanks on the outside and our soft unarmoured trucks with all our infantry in the middle of their protective box. So that was fine for the desert travelling at speed, but later on at Fondouk, when a big battle there, we were ordered to charge a minefield and hills in box formation. The net result was 40% casualties for us in our unarmoured soft vehicle trucks, and our sensible commanders after that never had us attacking in box formation again. But that was the problem of some of the training. It wasn't necessarily realistic, because the things coming back to us were not suitable for where we were actually going to fight, which included some of North Africa, where we were poised for, because there were hills and plains below them, and that was why at Fondouk we had the wrong tactics for the countryside we were there. So that was what set us off, and off we went, and the voyage was mainly quiet. One thing I remember was We left from up on the Clyde, and I can remember the sort of haunting sound of the bagpipes being played as we, which for that sort of occasion is an amazing music. And we had a fairly quiet trip over. Only two things I remember about it was when it began to get hot in the Mediterranean, because we were headed for Algiers, we were told by then. And when it began to get hot in the Mediterranean, I remembered a story my uncle had told me. He was on his way to a war, I think it was in Burma or somewhere, and he had to share he was then a junior lieutenant, he had to share a cabin with his company commander. And in the middle of the night, he was very much in need of a drink. So trying not to awake the commander, he crept there without putting on any light or anything and took a glass of water by the basin and saw it was full of stale water and chucked that out of the porthole before filling it up. Come the morning, he found out that he had also chucked out the colonel's only pair of teeth, false teeth, with the water. So that probably certainly inhibited the colonel's performance thereafter, and probably inhibited the time he took to reach colonel's rank. But I do remember him as a very powerful man, but with an enormous bunion about the size of a cricket ball on his neck, which used to be quite common in those days. And certainly he must have been very strong, because my mother had several marble statues of Buddha handed down, which he was said to have lumped for many a mile. My mother, incidentally, became early in the war, she joined the WBS and became deputy to Lady Petherick, who was head of the WBS in Kent. As such, she often drove it's a van with food, etc., up to the blazing docks. And while I was waiting for my call up, I occasionally went up with her. I also did a bit of hop picking. A lot of hop pickers used to get bus down from London, which they liked both the pocket money and getting out of London at the bombing time. Even so, and this was the nearest I ever came to being shot up by a Messerschmitt, one on its way home shot some of us up in the hop garden, letting off its remaining rounds, I suppose, as it went for home. And mother, while I was in this final bit of training, I tried to get a newsletter to all the members of my platoon. So I used to write that to mother, and she used to get it typed and circulated. And she did that, and also visiting many whenever I felt it would be good for somebody to be visited, she went and saw them. But she did that, the letters went on until this Fondouk battle I mentioned, where we had 40% casualties, and then it became a bit too much of a problem. So that was the situation when we went off. The only other thing on the voyage was a lecture by the doctor, which by the time he'd finished telling us all the terrible diseases we were likely to catch, our general thought was, well, why bother about the Germans when we're going to die of desperate diseases anyway? But the only constructive thing he did was to issue methacrine pills against malaria, and they turned your face as yellow as a Chinaman's, but they certainly seemed to do a good job. And I only had couple of minor attacks out there, and later on the only bad attack I got, which might have been unfortunate, was on my way to play at Wembley with a full house in the final of the Amateur FA Cup, which nearly prevented me, but because I was sent up, I developed a high temperature in the bus on the way, and was sent up to the first aid room, and was said to have a temperature of 103. So I told our manager that I was prepared to play, but I would stand down, because in those days there were no substitutes if he felt I wouldn't be up to it. But happily the one reserve we had said he'd just eaten a huge lunch and he didn't feel up to it either, so I was allowed to play in it. But otherwise we survived on the methacrine pills.
Can you recall the date that you sailed from the Clyde?
I think we must have sailed from the Clyde late October or early November 43, because the campaign we were going to lasted from, it would be 42, because it lasted from November 42 to May 43, right, yes. So that, and the only other thing on the voyage was that we had a quiet voyage to Algiers, but our other companies, some of our other companies, were in a ship collision near Gibraltar, and so were only minor problems, but so delayed about a fortnight or more before they joined us out there. And one company had been sent on ahead to join what was called Blade Force in an early dash for Tunis. But when we arrived at Algiers, and we were busy doing physical training on the deck to keep fit, because nobody could tell us whether we were going to land or not, and suddenly I recall a lone German plane came over, which nobody seemed to bother about, and it dropped a lone bomb on a corvette and disappeared again. We were all in our PT kit, just watched this in some surprise, because nobody fired at it, nothing happened, and it disappeared. And shortly after that, we got told we were being rushed ahead to Beaune to join, because the attack on Tunis appeared to be going so well that we would be rushed there to reinforce it. However, when we did arrive, and on the way, we suddenly realized that it mightn't be a very nice place, Beaune, because the vibrations of the ship as it sped there gave some indication that it was under threat from submarines and particularly from aircraft. And when we arrived and docked, the whole dock was covered in smoke, and there was both a merchant ship and a hospital ship sunk in the harbour. So we marched off pretty quickly with our packs and arms and everything, and we were marched to a huge tobacco warehouse with a concrete floor and glass ceiling or overhang. And on this rather uncomfortable floor we spent our nights, but by day, to our surprise, we weren't rushed up, which I now presume was because much of the transport was probably late arriving with the two companies that arrived late. But anyway, we couldn't understand it, because we just sat down there. We played some football with the French. We wandered around the town. And then my company commander, James Booth, who had been at Winchester with me, where he had in fact joined the Scouts because he disapproved of our training, but he'd done well enough to be my company commander and was a splendid one. And he, I think, quite rightly, as the town was being continually bombed, he thought it was too... And we weren't the only people in this... There were probably about 200 people in this tobacco warehouse. So he decided that one bomb might do such a massive destruction. So he marched us down to the beach at night. Unfortunately, it rained every night, and some planes dropped a bomb just about 50 yards from us, so he was not popular with the men. But I think he did quite right. And we kept on getting news, first of all, that things seemed to be going well, and we got news back from our B company with James Wilson, which had gone ahead, and they were making good progress. They had only one casualty, which was when they were taking a farm, and the officer got shot from by a machine gun and blinded. But otherwise, their progress had been quite quick, and there was the army news too. And then suddenly that all changed, because there'd been a major battle at Toborma, and the Hampshires had been heavily defeated and retired. That was only 7 miles from Tunis. So they nearly made it, and I think it must have been something like the being held up for lack of transport. Otherwise, why we weren't there rapidly to join it? Well, the Germans were still building up their forces, but we were then, after about 10 days, we were sent up just before Christmas, because the guards in the Bar Advance Party of our division had taken a key hill outside Tunis, Longstop Hill. They'd then handed it over to the Americans, who of course were terribly inexperienced then, and the Americans had been rapidly knocked off it. And so the Germans, and it was just before Christmas, and we were rushed up, but it was pouring with rain and everything was very muddy, and happily the attack we were meant to join in got cancelled, because in fact, with hindsight, the Germans had built up a much stronger force than us, and had we attacked this very difficult hill, Longstock, it would not have been a happy ending for me, I think. So instead we parked on muddy hills with nothing much happening for a week or so. The only extraordinary sight I witnessed was that our sappers were parked on a hill close by, and it actually cleared up that day, and a couple of Messerschmitts came over and did a run firing at the sappers' trucks, which they appeared to miss. They then went over the hill to turn round and come back for a second attack, but unfortunately for them, there were several Bofors anti-tank guns on the other side, and they shot the plane down. However, unfortunately for the sappers, the whole engine on fire went wheeling like a flaming cartwheel straight into their trucks and burnt four of them, so that actually the pilot did better when dead than alive. So that was one of the things. So then we finally got to Buaratu, which was a nice farm, which I recall had... It was owned by a very uncouth-looking farmer who was always unshaven and so on, with a very pretty wife and daughter, who I recall was, needless to say, very popular, was very friendly and invited people in for tea. But obviously the farmer didn't appreciate that. We overheard a terrible row one evening which ended with a "Mame les Arabes require," so it was clear what she was being accused of, quite unfairly, I'm sure. But then came the first battle I was involved with, after a whole series of patrols all over the place in front. We were about 10 miles from Pont de Far, which was meant to be the furthest place the Germans had got. But the first battle was when the Germans, to our great surprise, occupied in force what was called Two Tree Hill, though they very soon cut down the two trees, as they were rather good aiming points. And they occupied it, and that had been our observation post over the whole of the Gubelat plain and all the way to Pont de Var, so very important. But we hadn't had anything on it except a couple of observers who thought we were going to be attacked there. The only attack had been a small German reconnaissance party had attacked the outskirts of the farm, a hedge, where fortunately was a section dug in, and they soon saw them off. But the exchange of fire meant that the French, who were on our right, came roaring down to our unneeded assistance. And of course they all came in trucks with blazing lights. Of course we'd never driven with even a sidelight for years, So that was an amazing sight to us. But we were then ordered, as soon as it was found they'd occupied this hill, we were then ordered to go up and attack it, and this was the company's strength. And this was probably our part of the division's first action, really. And we drove up. Fortunately, the Germans hadn't, because they overlooked the farm and the road and everything from Two Tree Hill. And had they had any field artillery, I think it would have been a rather uncomfortable drive. And then when we debussed, there was no sort of reaction from Two Tree Hill. No mortars, no shells, no long-range machine guns. So we formed up, and there were a couple of red cloth hats, so the generals were there to see what happened, as this was the first one. And the plan was to attack down the valley leading to the hill. And as the Germans also had taken a spur running out from it on the left, that didn't seem a very... We had some tanks, a few old Valentors, small gun Valentine tanks. There were probably about five or six tanks going down, and the company, but with the hill strongly held, it was very clear they weren't going anywhere. But meanwhile, I'd been told to take a section of six with a Bren gun and rifles, of course, and go and see if the other ridge, which fortunately didn't jut out from the hill but went close to it, the ridge on the other side, if that was held, and if so, to clear it. And fortunately it wasn't, but in this odd battle, there was no sound of shelling, no great sound of machine guns. There was the odd sound of what I soon became to recognise as anti-tank guns. They had a very distinctive flat bark when they fired, and of course they were fired at such speed you didn't hear them coming, unlike field artillery, which they're arching shells and you heard them coming. So I heard some artillery, some anti-tank fire, but I don't think I couldn't see that we lost any tanks, because fortunately my spur had been unoccupied. And of course when I saw the Germans on the opposite ridge, about 500 yards away, looking down on our attack as if they were watching a play, and I suppose they were leaving it to the people on the hill, they didn't seem to be actually doing anything about it. So it was a very strange battle. But when I saw them, I ordered everybody to set their sights at 500 yards, and when I gave the about to give the order to fire, when the Bren gunner collapsed in tears and said he didn't want to kill anybody, so I took over the Bren gun, as I was at least well trained in that, though the man thereafter was to fight as bravely as the rest. But I can imagine, you know, that was how some people felt in their first battle, a terrible problem for them. Anyway, I don't think we hit anybody, but we cleared the ridge. I think they were just ducking out of it. And our carrier platoon under Bob Fairweather, we found that some Germans, had in fact infiltrated across the road we'd driven up to the hills behind. And they were holed up in a farm, and Bob took his carriers there and put it under intense Bren gun fire, which is a machine gun, of course. And that led to all of them either being killed or made prisoners, several prisoners. So it was, in a way, an all-square little battle, except that they stayed on this dominant hill, and I never knew why they didn't make better use of it. Because, for instance, later we had a battery of guns actually in at the back of the side of the farm, and they were heavily shelled just for a few minutes, and then they left off doing it and never tried to shell them again, and not having hit anybody the first time. But fortunately, the lesson that was learnt by the top brass was that they needed to hold their observation post in strength. So just in time, two companies, my C company and Jim Wilson's A company, were sent out at midnight to occupy here. I should remember, it's the Argoub. It was called Argoub El Hanek, which was a field that which was a hill that overlooked the road a long way towards Pont du Far, and it overlooked a smaller hill about a bit over a mile away with a farm behind it, which I'd often patrol. And so we drove up probably about 2:30 in the morning, pouring rain, lots of mud, and so getting the trucks hidden away in the slush and so on was difficult enough. And